Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today I'm very honored to have as my guest Yusuf Komunyakaa, the author most recently of War Horses, a book of poems published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. His recent titles include Taboo, Talking Dirty to the Gods. There's a big book of his collected poems, Pleasure Dome, New and Collected Poems. The book Neon Vernacular, New and Selected Poems, had won the Pulitzer Prize. And his work is very well available. But what fascinates me about it is the sense of a hard-won voice. People have written about how for 12 years after coming home from Vietnam, that was not a part of your poetry. For 12 years, are those 12 years of a waiting formulation?
Actually, it was really 14 years. Early on, I didn't think of my experience in Vietnam as that for poetry. I was really taken with the writers at the time I was reading, informed by surrealism, some of the negritude poets as well. So I accidentally stumbled upon what I knew best, what I had internalized, that war in Vietnam. And it opened other doors with less war-related subject matter as well.
That process of internalization, can you describe it? Because in the new book, the third poem, The Autobiography of My Alter Ego, there's a section in which that alter ego speaks of his shyness and his inability to speak before his father. And from time to time, when I meet poets who studied with you, they speak of how you rarely spoke.
Right. There was an intense shyness growing up, but I grew up in Bogalusa, Louisiana, and it was really a mecca for understanding elements of the world, I think, because I would wander out into the woods seeking a certain kind of identity with that which was around me. I do have a great capacity for listening, and I think perhaps I've been informed by that capacity, listening. But I've also talked myself into being more direct. As far as speech and all of that goes as well, I try not to confront as much as listen.
I don't know how to put this exactly, but when I'm reading the poems, it's as if they're compounded out of words forming one big word.
Right.
And
right.
That one big word is the poem.
Yeah.
And it's full of pulsating pasts and presents, and that we see almost as in Guernica a sense of superimposed and simultaneously past and present realities, and that the poem has been made or hasn't come until what it solidifies has become sufficiently stable.
Right. I think about how things are constructed. My great-grandfather was a carpenter. My father was a carpenter. And I've been thinking recently if that informed my process, because I think about how things solidify and become heft and at the same time, lightness. So language is important to me. Music is important to me. Language is of a very first music, and the body is an amplifier. So I think in that way, I read everything aloud as I'm writing the poem. So, and anything that's extraneous, I try to cut away. My method is to improvise, to have everything come flowing down, and then cut it back to its necessary components. And sometimes there are elements of this discursion. There are discursive elements introduced into the terrain.
Well, a carpenter works with the grain of the wood.
Yes.
Is that what language brings to the poem, that words contain their own elements that need to be worked into the rhythm and the feel of the flow of the poem?
Yes, yes. Because in thinking about it as music, it depends on what word falls left or right of a given word to, in a way, shape the music of the word in the center. Because we're thinking about phrases as such. I don't really notate the poem in that sense, but I think reading it aloud, the ear is a great editor. The ear keeps me true to the language. That's the way that I think about it. And the poem is a made thing in that sense. It's a made thing that, in a way, approaches mystery.
Absolutely. I thought we'd listen to some of the poems in the first section so that listeners can hear some of the things that occur in these poems. One of the first shocks that I register is the recognition, yes, the masters of shock and awe are the same suitors surrounding and waiting for Penelope to make a choice, that love and war have been cognate in the absence of Ulysses, and that these potential husbands are also generals, and they've been asked not just to conquer Penelope, but to perform an astonishing feat of shooting an arrow.
Right, 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 right.
Ability to bend a bow has defined him as a warrior. Mm. So has it been the defining quality of many of the heroes in the Trojan War.
Right.
There are bows, in other words, too strong to be bent by lesser men.
Right, right, right. right.
And women too sacred
right.
to be bedded by anyone but their hero husband. Mm. Part of what that poem is about. Let's hear the poem dedicated to Penelope and waiting for Ulysses. And in particular, let's think about the brass key and what it's a door to. This is Yosef Komunaka reading. These poems are untitled. It's one of the 12 sections of Love in the Time of War.
Here, the old masters of shock and awe huddle in the war room, talking iron, fire and sand, alloy and nomenclature. Their hearts lag against the bowstring as they daydream of Odysseus' bed. But to shoot an arrow through the bullseye of 12 axes lined up in a row is to sleep with one's eyes open. Yes, of course, there stands lovely Penelope, like a trophy, still holding the brass key against her breast. How did the even star fall into that room? Lost between plot and lute, the plucked string turns into a lyre, a humming, praises and curses to the unborn.
I find that although our phrase, shock and awe, is used here, that in the context we think of the tragic responses of pity and shock.
Shock, yes.
Yes.
Yes, for sure.
And that these poems are trying to find a place in language where love and war can stand together in their multifold possibility.
That which makes us human, in that sense. And it's all the conflict, it's all the contradictions side by side.
Now, does war make us human, too?
Perhaps so. But I do think that often individuals measure themselves against the odds through war. But it's also, if we think about it, in contemporary society, contemporary time, that is the place of negotiation. We should be more creative as human beings at this moment in our history.
We notice in the poem that the in their war room, the men speaking of shock and awe don't seem to regard the woman that they vie for as being someone who can make a decision.
Right. Yeah. Many contradictions there.
Yes. They own her, whatever her decision is, it will be one of them. And it will take the return of another man, the man to whom the brass key belongs. But at the same time, in these poems, there's a whole play of metal, gold and brass, and the sense of the Iron Age, the Bronze Age, that war is part of the history of the working of metal.
Right. Because I think before tools were fashion, instruments of war were fashion. The whole machinery of war is rather problematic in that sense. And yet, it is aligned with so-called progress.
Let's hear, because almost immediately following, we hear the voice of Eve and her birthing, warring sons, Cain and Abel. Right next to this poem about the return of Ulysses to Penelope. And I... Well, let's hear it first.
My wide hips raise two warriors from sweat and clay, blood sonata and birth cry. I said anger and avarice, and they called themselves Cain and Abel. I said goal, and they open up the earth. I said love, and they ventured east and west, south and north. I said evil, and they lost themselves and reflected rivers. After scrimmages across
Asia Minor, and guarding kingly ransom in the Horn of Africa, my sons journeyed home to peasant bread and salt meat, to whorish doubts and wonder. But when I flung my arms open at the threshold, they came to me as unseasoned boys.
This, in a sense, is the next shock that we're going to follow through the poems. First, the generation of the generals who appropriate this woman, whatever her choice is, and now the poet appropriating the woman's voice. And throughout this series of poems, the possibility of double sexedness, double voicedness, omni sexedness is raised. Yes?
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Can you speak about this?
I do think that we are indebted to each other, and consequently, we can have empathy, and sometimes it's through through the sexes. Not that it's thought out in any way, but it's just the human element, the human elements attempting to come together in some fruitful design. Not as contest, but perhaps as some moment of deep worship, I hope.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Yosef Kamenyaka, author most recently of War Horses, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Yosef Kamenyaka about the poetry in his book, War Horses. The next poem we'll hear is the poem that people, I think, associate with Achilles and Patroclus, of warriors become lovers, and the act of war as an act of love, and then subsequently the act of sex as a mirror of the act of war.
Hand to hand, the two hugged each other into a naked tussle, one riding the other's back, locked in a double embrace. One forced the other to kiss the ground as he cursed and bit into an earlobe. They shook beads of dew off the grass. One worked his fingers into the black soil and could feel a wing easing out of his capilla. That night, the lucky one who gripped the stone like Mercury wound the planet on his palm. Who knew windfall and downfall? He fell against his sweetheart again and again, as if holding that warrior in his arms. He couldn't stop himself from rising off the earth.
I'm curious because, you know, for me, I do think a poet is different from other people, and even from other poets. And right. I wonder about the sensitivity that a poet has to have, and what would you say, a kind of shield a poet has to construct against the subject of the poem. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that for you, the poem is such a powerful thing that it takes years not just to construct, but to feel safe enough to approach the subject.
One has to go over and over in one's head, one's mind, how he or she can approach the topic. And if we are brave enough to approach the topic at the moment, but the time comes, we are, at least for myself, I think I'm obsessed. There's a healthy obsession with getting it right, but also not so much coming to answers as much as posing questions. I think the poem is really a composite of small bridges. At first, it happens inside the writer. It's that attempt to align the outside world with the internal world. That's the first bridge that happens. And then we can worry about if the poem connects to others. But if we can be true to language and be true to ourselves, then at least there's a void that takes place.
Now, then, people who read you and who've read about you know that you've suffered a great deal.
Right.
And that you've had personal tragedy in your life. And I have no intention of being presumptuous or cruel enough to speak of that.
But
the sense then that there are readers who await in poetry your processing of those materials, what is that like?
Well, I think that the poet in general has this dialogue with oneself. And it's not so much in the presence of the spoken as much as the still moment of meditation.
But it doesn't seem in your work to be mental. It seems to come from the intestines, from the gut.
Right. It's interesting because if we think about someone was speaking to me recently about grief and the idea of lying stomach down on the ground and letting the earth not overcome the grief, but at least inform the individual about the grief. And so that's interesting to me. And it seems rather ancient. But we do try and connect ourselves to the larger world, to its elements, as well as its mysteries.
Your voice, just your speaking voice, comes from deep inside. That's not a head voice. And it seems to me that it comes from where the poetry wants most to come from, the heart, and the heart as the gateway or doorway to the soul. And that frequently, this talk of bridges, of keys, of doorways, are about making that spelunking voyage, caves, people waiting at the mouths of caves for the thoughts to come out. But often it seems as if the poem is the god that's awaited at the doorway to the cave. Does that make sense?
Well, one hopes that it is worth waiting for, in that sense. But and maybe it's the surprise. Maybe it's that, why do poets write? That becomes a very interesting question. I think early on, it was really to face the immense mystery of the world. And perhaps that's the reason that Plato banishes the poet from his ideal republic, because he or she troubles the waters.
I'd like to end by listening to a final poem by our guest, Yosef Komunaka.
When our hands caress bullets and grenades, or linger on the turrets and luminous wings of reconnaissance planes, we leave glimpses of ourselves on the polished hardness. We surrender skin, hair, sweat, and fingerprints. The assembly lines hum to our touch, and the grinding wheels record our laments and laughter into the bright metal. I touch your face, your breasts, the flower holding a world in focus. We give ourselves to each other, letting the workday slide away. Afterwards, lying there facing the sky, I touch the crescent-shaped war wound. Yes, the oldest prayer is still in my fingertips.
That was Yosef Komunaka reading a poem from his new book, War Horses, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you, Yosef, for joining us. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.